Okay, Matthew 19. And what I wanted to kind of start off and note is that this particular issue is an issue, as verse 3 tells us, that the Pharisees asked Jesus about. They are described here as asking him and testing him, asking the question, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for just any reason? That is a question that that we ask in our society today as well, with varied answers. But it is interesting to note that it is not only in our society that this is problematic. It was actually that way in Jesus' day as well. A lot of differences of opinion as to what is intended with regard to God's laws on marriage. And we'll see that that is the case as we get into the text. Would someone like to read to me the first, I'll say the first 10 verses. Verses 1 through 10. Okay, thank you, Jake. Appreciate it.
Now it came to pass, when Jesus finished these sayings, that he departed from Galilee and came to the region of Judea beyond Jordan. A great multitude followed him, and he healed them. The Pharisees also came him, testing him, saying to him, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for just any reason? And he answered and said to them, have you not read that he who has made them at the beginning made them male and female, and said, for this reason, man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they two shall become one flesh. So then there is no longer two, but one flesh. Therefore, what God has joined together, let no man separate. They said to him, why then did Moses command to give certificate of divorce and to put her away? And he said, Moses, because of his hardness of your hearts, permitted the divorce of your wives, but from the beginning it was not so. And I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality and marries another commits adultery, and whoever marries her who has divorced commits adultery. This his disciples said to him, if such a case of a man with his wife, it is better not to marry.
Thank you. As you were reading that, I was following along in my New Testament, and it was copyright for the New King James Version in 1979, and my Bible that I use for preaching and contains the Old Testament as well is copyright 94. There's actually a change in the sixth verse with regard. Not a big deal, but I'll just read the what he read, because I knew he was reading from the New King James. Everything was matching up. But what Jay read is, so then they are no longer two but one flesh, therefore what God has joined together, let not man separate. Whereas the first version of the New King James was, so then they are no longer two but one flesh, therefore what God has joined together, let not man divide. Just kind of an interesting thing. I don't know why they made the change, because divide and separate pretty much mean the same thing, but I guess they thought that separate was a little bit more accurate, possibly.
What's the difference between separate and divide?
I don't know that there is one. That's why it makes me wonder why they, what they, because I knew that that was the, of course, I've been studying out of that for 30 years, that one Bible. So I knew it was separate. When I read it here, I thought, wait a second. But this is just an earlier version of the New King James Bible. So, nobody else is interested in that, but it was interesting to me. So. All right. So actually looking at our study today, I just want you to note specifically what is said by the Pharisees in verse 7 to introduce our time together. Because after Jesus gives his response to their answer, they ask the question, why then did Moses command to give a certificate of divorce to put her away? I mentioned just a few moments ago that this was an issue that was a contentious issue in the first century. And the reason for that was the passage to which the Pharisees made reference here in that verse. It is a passage in Deuteronomy chapter 24. And so what happened was that, and this was actually before Jesus was born, there were two rabbis that were very influential teachers. One's name was Shammai, and his theological opponent was Hillel. I don't know if I'm pronouncing that correct, but that's the basic spelling of the two names. And they were they lived at the same time, contemporaries, and they took two very different views of what Deuteronomy 24 allowed. And so I'd like you to just go with me to Deuteronomy chapter 24, and I want to read the four verses and note especially a term that's found in the first verse, and then explain what the positions were commonly in that day. Again, these two men lived before Jesus, but the schools of thought were very much in vogue and argued at this particular time, as Jesus was teaching. Deuteronomy 24, verse 1, and this is the commandment to which they refer that Moses had given. In verse 1, when a man takes a wife and marries her, and it happens that she finds no favor in his eyes because he has found some uncleanness in her, and he writes her a certificate of divorce, puts it in her hand, and sends her out of his house. When she has departed from his house and goes and becomes another man's wife, if the latter husband detests her and writes her a certificate of divorce, puts it in her hand, sends her out of his house, or if the latter husband dies who took her as his wife, then her former husband who divorced her must not take her back to be his wife after she has been defiled. For that is an abomination before the Lord, and you shall not bring sin on the land which the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance. That's a very wordy and lengthy law that Moses gave in this particular text, or a commandment that Moses gave in this text. But you'll notice what he was doing is limiting the practice of divorce and remarriage. In this particular case, someone who has been divorced cannot be taken back according to the law. And there was some abuse that was ongoing in Israel that led to Moses doing this. In fact, Jesus referred to it in Matthew chapter 19 and verse 8. He said, Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts, permitted you to divorce your wives, but from the beginning it was not so. One of those interesting passages, it was allowed by Moses that a divorce take place, and the reason where a divorce could take place is because he has found some uncleanness in her. Now the question is, and this is the question that was debated between Shammai and Hillel, is what is uncleanness? What was Moses talking about with regard to that? And there were two basic views that were held. Shammai's his view was that this has reference to sexual conduct, that the uncleanness has reference to sexual conduct. Now, there's a problem with that particular view, and that is that whenever a woman was caught in adultery, the penalty was not that she got divorced, but that she was stoned to death, which you remember that Jesus had the woman brought to him caught in the very act of adultery, and they were testing him to see whether he would say to stone her. And so that was one point to be made that would indicate perhaps that's not the uncleanness. It's not referring to that. But Hillel went to the opposite extreme and said basically any minor thing would be just cause for the divorce. Even an example was given that was spelled out, and that is if she were to spill her husband's food, that such an indiscretion or a mistake made could be just cause for divorce. So those are the two basic things. Only for some type of a sexual immorality or sexual misconduct, or maybe a more minor thing. Now, the sexual misconduct could be inclusive of other things other than adultery or fornication. It could also be including immodesty and other kinds of things, which I believe most probably was what was under consideration, is some moral failing on her part. But both of those things were being debated in the days of Jesus. So, having said that, it becomes somewhat understandable that their response to him in Matthew 19 and verse 8 is, why then did Moses command to give her a certificate of divorce if you say that you can't do it? And they're saying, we do have the right to do it. We want to know how often. And of course, they were testing him, basically saying, which side are you going to come down on in regard to this? And by the way, and I wasn't as familiar with this particular thing, but there is another rabbi that taught, actually, a contemporary of Jesus. His name was Akiba, A-K-I-B-A. And he took a position that was based not on that term uncleanness in the view of that term, but rather in the phrase before that, which stated, going back up to do it happens that she finds no favor in his eyes. He was basically ignoring the because he has found uncleanness, but if for whatever reason she had no favor in his eyes, and he took that to mean even if, well, I found another woman that I like that's more attractive to me. In other words, my view of my wife has changed because I prefer someone else. And that's all that it would take for him to have the right to divorce. Now, the reason I bring this up is, you know, those are kind of basically rationalizations, obviously, to do what you want to do. It's identical to what we find today. Individuals who, for whatever reason, whatever theory that they come up with regard to divorce and then remarriage, they will explain away the teaching that is done here in Matthew 19, so that they're able to do whatever it is that they want to do. And there's always that danger. Whenever we're studying an issue, and the issue is a divisive issue, that you allow yourself to be colored in your thinking based upon a desire on your part. We always need to be careful not to allow that happen. How does that happen? Well, certainly an individual in a relationship that they don't want to be in. If I can find a justification for getting out of that relationship that someone holds to, you know, find the people who heap up to themselves teachers having itching ears, turning their hearts away from truth. If I can find that, then I can say, well, brother so-and-so, he agrees with me. And as a result of that, perhaps have some justification for their actions. Another reason why this happens is that you have family that is caught up in these things, to where a particular circumstance arises, to where someone's divorced and remarried, and you're looking for justification where you can approve of that new relationship that they're in. And by the way, there are plenty of theories out there. And Ron Halbrook he used to preach a lesson on this particular thing, and one of the charts in the lesson was spin the wheel of adultery and the wheel of fortune, spin it, and there's all these theories that was on his chart of this big round thing, and the one thing that they all had in common, whether it's redefining what adultery is, or if the bond is broken for one is broken for others, or race, of the, you know, all these different views that come up. The alien center's not amenable. He had about 15 of them up there, but you spin the wheel and you get a new mate every time. That's kind of the view. Now, I'm not going to say that every single one who holds to false position on it that's true, because I don't know the motivations of any. But I say it as a means of warning, that you cannot allow what you want, what you desire, to color your thinking. And it happens too often. And this is especially problematic in our society today. And it's very similar to what we find back in the first century with regard to the Jews at that time. So just kind of a cautionary tale. If you have something that you want to do, people typically will find somewhere in Scripture where they can conform it to their thinking. And typically it's by twisting it, wresting it to their own destruction. But it is possible to do that, and it's typical.
That rabbi that said that you could leave your divorce wife for any reason you wanted to. Mm-hmm. I mean, John the Baptizer lost his head for nothing.
That's exactly right. Yeah, and it's kind of an interesting point, is that where Jesus was at this particular time, we're told that he had departed from Galilee and came to the region of Judea beyond the Jordan, which would be an indication of the eastern side of the Jordan River, which was in that region, Judea and the eastern side, that was under the power of Herod. And you know, they knew, these Pharisees knew that Herod had been beheaded by angry Herod, And why did he anger Herod? It's not lawful for you to have her. So the speculation this particular commentator made is that perhaps they were trying to, in testing him, is get him on the record of advocating the same position that John the Baptist did, because that might anger Herod yet again. And as a result of that, it may cause problems for Jesus. Kind of an interesting thing, but that is indeed true, that if Hillel was correct, then John the Baptist's position, that Herod had no right to Herodias because she was his brother Philip's wife, even though she had divorced Philip and married him, then there wouldn't be anything unlawful about that, as John the Baptist had claimed. So, it's kind of an interesting thing. So you can see where John the Baptist came down on the argument with regard to that. All right, so just kind of some introductory thoughts that I wanted to share with you before we get into the discussion itself. Anybody want to add anything to that or talk about it at all?
So there was two things going on when the Pharisees came to him. Then there was already controversy in the land, mm-hmm. over the subject of divorce. And also, we can take it for granted that Jesus has already been teaching the truth on marriage and divorce. So that's why they're coming to him and asking this question, hoping to trip him up.
Yeah, Matthew chapter 5, which is right. The Sermon on the Mount earlier in his ministry, he had come out very clearly with regard to that. And, you know, we may have an opportunity or reason to go to Matthew 5 a little bit later on. I've made note of to bring it up if it's beneficial in this, because there are a number of times when Jesus is on the record of dealing with this particular issue. Okay, so in verse 4, the question is it lawful for a man to divorce? That is the word apoluso, or apoluse, in the Greek, and it is more literally rendered put away. And in fact, it is a generic term, a generic phrase. You know, we have a legal term or word, which is divorce. The term that was used to signify the certificate of divorce, you know, that idea of an actual ending of a marriage, a cultural ending of a marriage, in Deuteronomy chapter 24, they used the phrase put away. And in fact, the book, chapter in Luke, I believe it's chapter 18, if I remember correctly. Let me see if I can find that. Now, all of a sudden, I'm 16. Where is it where Jesus refers to them leaving their father and mother, and why all of a sudden I can't find it?
Mark 10.
The reference is in Luke that I'm thinking of. Oh, yeah, it is. It is Luke 18. I just went right over. Notice in Luke 18 and verse 28. And the word, he said to them, "Surely I say to you, there is no one who has left house or parents or brothers or wife or children for the sake of the kingdom of God shall not receive many times more in the present time and in the age to come everlasting life." The word left there is the same. It's a separation. So it's the same term. It's a general term. But in this case, contextually, it has reference to... In this case, the significance is in the man causing her to leave or putting her away. But it is that separation that's under consideration that leads to an end of the marriage. So that's the concept that's under consideration in verse 4. And the question is, can you do that for just any reason? So I want you to notice a couple of things in regard to this. Whenever we go down to verse 9, which is the significant teaching that is found here, with regard to marriage, divorce, and remarriage, this is not what we would refer to as Jesus' law with regard to marriage, divorce, remarriage. Jesus' law with regard to marriage, divorce, remarriage is established in verse 6 of the text. That's the law. So let's read it. So he asked the question, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for just any reason? He makes reference to Genesis chapter 2 and verse 24. Genesis chapter 2 and verse 24, a man shall leave his father and mother, be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. That's what the text says. Have you not read that he who made them at the beginning made them male, female, and said, for this reason a man shall leave his father and mother, be joined to his wife, the two shall become one flesh. So it's a reference to Genesis chapter 2 and verse 24 with Jesus' divine commentary. Now, what I'm saying is, from this is what Jesus said that passage meant. And because Jesus said that passage meant that, that settles the issue. Now, it didn't settle it in the minds of the Pharisees, but we're believers in Jesus Christ. And typically, when we're talking about the concept of divorce and remarriage, there are two kinds of people that we'll address in regard to this. Number one, you're going to address someone who's in the world. And you say to them in the world is that you cannot divorce and remarry for any reason. And they'll ask you, well, why? Well, because Jesus said so. Well, that's not necessarily going to satisfy them. You have to first establish the lordship of Jesus Christ, which if they are accepting of that, they'll become Christians, and then that will be a binding thing with regard to them. I want you to notice that in verse 6, he says, so then, that's his reasoning as a result of what is said about marriage in Genesis 2:24. This is what Jesus is reasoning, so then. And also down in verse 9, he says, I say unto you. So Jesus is speaking with authority on this particular issue. The other kind of individual you'll take a position or state a position with regard to marriage or remarriage, and they may disagree with you based upon the interpretation. But the point is this, what Jesus has to say on this is indeed authoritative and must be heeded. We must recognize it. So what is his law? So then they are no longer two but one flesh. Therefore, this is the law. What God has joined together, let not man divide. That answers their question. The question was, is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any reason? His answer was, what God has joined together, let not man divide. That's the answer. That's the law. So what that indicates is that marriage is a lifetime commitment. And man is not to separate from his wife. You ask the question, who is the man under consideration here? Because I remember very early on when I first kind of studying this and say, therefore what God has joined together, let not man divide, is that men should not try to come between a man and his wife. But that's not the point. Jesus is asking, or the Pharisees were asking, I am a husband, can I put my wife away? No, man is not to divide. I don't have the right to put my wife away for any cause. What God's joined together, God is the one who's always joining, man is not to divide. He's not to put asunder. Now, go over very quickly to Romans chapter 6. Romans chapter 7. I don't know why it says 6. Romans chapter 7. And this same point is made in this particular text by the Apostle Paul. I want you to notice what it said beginning in verse 2. He's using the husband-wife relationship to make a point about the old law. But the point is a valid point. Verse 2. The woman who has a husband is bound by the law to her husband as long as he lives. That's just stated in the same, in different words, the exact same point. God has joined them together. She is bound by the law to her husband as long as he lives. What God has joined together, man is not to divide, or man is not to separate. Continuing on there in Romans 6 and verse 2, if the husband dies, she's released from the law of her husband. That simply indicates that the husband-wife relationship is a lifelong relationship, that death dissolves that bond that God has bound them to. He has joined them together for life. And so, if then, verse 3, while her husband lives, she marries another man, which is exactly what Jesus is talking about in Matthew chapter 19:9. She will be called an adulteress. But if her husband dies, she's free from the law, so that she is no adulteress, though she has married another man. Now that's the law established. The interesting thing about these passages is when we talk about the law with regard to the marriage relationship, it is a very, very simple law. And that law, and I use this, I know that y'all have heard me preach on it, have heard it many, many times. It's certainly not unique to me. I didn't come up with it, but it's a very simple way of putting it. You have one man, one woman, for a lifetime. That's God's law on marriage. And these are not suggestions. These are not explanations of what the best way of doing it is. When an individual violates that law and marries again, he becomes guilty of adultery. The woman as well. We'll look at the various aspects of that. So law is asked and answered, or the question is asked and answered. Is it lawful? No, it's not lawful. The answer is no. Now, as typically happens when that answer is given, someone says, but what if? You know, that, in other words, whenever a question is asked and just a straightforward, simple answer is given, it often does not satisfy entirely. People aren't just happy with it because they want to have some way of wiggling out from under that. And so that's what happened in verse 7 of the text. These Pharisees were familiar with Deuteronomy 24, familiar with Shammai and Hillel and what they taught, and perhaps Akiva as well, although I think he was more minor with regard to his views and his followers. But these were the views that they had been arguing about, and there were different ideas that people had and different groups that people would fall into as to what they believe. And now they're asking Jesus, and Jesus is basically giving this law which seems to have absolutely no wiggle room at all. And so they ask the question then, why did Moses command to give a certificate of divorce and put her away? Now, have you ever heard this phrase that Moses commanded, but Moses didn't command, Moses permitted, so command is the wrong way of putting it. Because I've actually heard that. But the interesting thing is, when you go over to Mark and look at Mark's discussion of that same thing, notice what they said in verse 4. Moses permitted writing, or it was come from verse 3. He answered and said to them, what? I'm sorry.
Chapter 10.
Yes, Mark 10, verse 3. He answered and said to them, what did Moses command you? And they said, Moses permitted writing a certificate of divorce to put her away. So he used the word command, they used the word permit. Now, no discrepancy in regard to this, because basically what Matthew and Mark were establishing is the same point, is Jesus was wanting to know what Moses said about it, wanting them on the record as to what Moses said about it, and then he answered them. And the answer was that this circumstance or situation came about as a result of sin that was present, so that he could make the contrast, but from the beginning it was not so. So what Jesus is doing is taking them back to the way God intended in the beginning, and by his authority saying, this is what I command of you. So what that does under the new covenant is that though we find some significance in what is being said in Deuteronomy chapter 24, Deuteronomy chapter 24 is no longer applicable, because Jesus is establishing his teaching and what he requires under his covenant for us today. And now I'm not in any way seeking to dismiss that concept of it wasn't command or but rather permitted, because you'll notice in the language used in Matthew chapter 19, they said to him, why then did Moses command to give her a certificate of divorce and to put her away? It was stated as a you know, this is Moses, this is what Moses is commanding, when obviously Moses didn't command them to divorce their wives. What Jesus is establishing here is that what Moses put as a commandment was to regulate the actions, the activities that were already going on as a result of the sinful actions of these individuals, the hardness of their hearts. They were already putting away their wives. What he was doing is limiting what they could do, the mistreatment of the wives, to where it sounds like they were almost wife swapping from time to time. It just, you know, I can put her away, and then later on, if I want to take her back, I can take her back, and then I can put her away, and that kind of thing was an abomination to God. He didn't want it, and so Moses put a limit to what could be done. So, in that particular point, I want you to note a couple of things about verse 8, and that is the Pharisees had that idea that this has the force of commandment, as if it's a righteous thing, when in reality, divorcing your wife for a cause, any cause, is not a righteous thing at all. It was something that was being practiced, but it's not something that was acceptable to God. And then secondly, that uncleanness was being interpreted very broadly by a large group of people, and Jesus wasn't going to allow that to pass. And that's where we get into verses 8 and 9 and his further explanation that we'll talk about in a moment. Hope that's not confusing to you, but I did want to make note of the flip-flop with regard to the actual terms that were used in Mark chapter 10 and verses 3 and following. Okay, so verses 8 and 9, this is the key. This is the, you know, the meat. So we'll start there in a moment. Anybody listen?
There's something gelling in my mind. And that's always dangerous when you try to explain something that, you know, you're thinking, haven't really had an opportunity to think through yet. But what you said a while ago about Deuteronomy 24 is very key. First off, a real quick observation. Mark 10 allows no exception.
Yep.
It's not even touched on there.
Yeah.
Even when he gave no exception to the Pharisees, and even when he got back to the house, the disciples asked him at the house, he did not give an exception. He just said, This is what's to be. What's really key here is the hardness of their hearts. The hardness of their hearts meant they were what? They were in sin. They were already condemned. If they could not repent of the hardness of their hearts, then they're not going to be forgiven anyway. So what Moses was doing, he was not giving them permission even to divorce their wives. They were divorcing their wives. He's not the one that came up with the plan for writing the writ of divorcement. They did that. He's saying, since you are doing this, don't commit this abomination that you talked about. He said, that is really bad. We're not going to allow this. You touched on a while ago. What was the penalty, you know, for adultery? The things that Jesus is talking about in his exception. The penalty was death. It was still death at the time Jesus talked about this. He's looking to the future too, obviously. When the old law will no longer be in effect and there will not be that penalty. But the thing that's gelling in my mind is, we as Christians run to Matthew 19:9, right? And we think that gives us permission to divorce our wives for this exception. Well, does it really? Why would we do that if it wasn't for the hardness of our own hearts? And he's allowing the thing because our hearts are not right, but we've got to get over that problem that we had. Now, there's a flip side of that, and that's the one, and that's the fact that he committed adultery and is worthy of death because of the act. But under his law, they will no longer be put to death. So if sinned against spouse so chooses, they can put him away. But that's not a command to put him away.
Not a command.
Yep. It's not a command.
It's a permission.
But it seems to be here. He's not really. He's talking about then and there under the Pharisees. What the Pharisees was asking is, can I put him away because he spilled my food? He said, no, you can't do that. If you're going to put him away, let it only be for this reason. And again, he's not giving them permission to do it. He's saying, if you're going to do it, you're still doing it out of the hardness of your heart. Does that make any sense?
No.
The view, this is the part that you mentioned that I would also, I think, take issue with, at least in part, is the idea that the death penalty is something that was taken away under the new covenant. And of course, this teaching is Christ's teaching, I say to you, this point, which would be looking to the future as well. But that the death penalty with regard to adultery indicates the heinousness and seriousness of that particular sin as far as a consequence. And so with regard to that, we ask the question in this particular exception that is given in Matthew 19, and we haven't had a chance yet to get into the text, but as far as the discussion of it, but there is an exception that's given in that text, and that is sexual immorality. And whatever that is defined as, which we'll do in a moment, that is an exception that is given in the text. To where, this is where it goes in, to where when an individual divorces his life for that cause, then what's implied in the text, adultery is not committed when they remarry. Whereas in every other instance it is. So what you have is a situation to where you're not guilty of sinning in the new relationship. I don't think that we have any indication at all with regard to the nature of the remainders, what led to it, what was the situation, what were the circumstances that combined. Because often there is hardness of hearts that are present on the side of the individual who is doing the divorcing. And that has to be repented of. I just don't know that the text would require that there is. Now, in this case, he's specifying that it was the hardness of the hearts of Israel that led to this particular law.
Yeah. I'm not saying that the sin against party cannot do it, because clearly he says that they can't. But he's saying what Deuteronomy 24 is talking about is this. It's not talking about spilled food, it's this. But still, the writing of divorce came out of the hardness of their hearts. See, that was the whole reason for the divorces to be going on, was because of the hardness of their hearts. And like you said, that can be repented of if that's the case. You know, and should be, obviously.
Yeah. Sorry.
Because you raise the question, and this comes up not as much in discussions like this. What's the difference between the spouse that forgives a spouse and the one that doesn't? What's the failure in the other one, if you can call it a failure? See what I'm saying?
Right.
It's the failure in the spouse. There's no. I can see that. There's no repentance on the part of the spouse. And if that's the case, why subject yourself to further abuse, right?
Yeah, right.
So put that one away. But
often that's not the case.
Right.
And yeah, it's a, you know, when people bring up situations like that and expressing it, you know, there are some who would say it's required that if they repent, that the marriage remained in place. And while I understand that that's the best thing, if you can work, if you can do that, again, I think there is permission given for the putting away in Matthew chapter 19 for that cause. And but the question, the other thing it impacts that, as I alluded to, which this may not even be tangential to what you're saying, but it's nevertheless the case, is that if a husband is unfaithful to his wife, but the wife has refrained from the attention that is due him, then she's not sinless in regard to that. She's violated sinners, violated God's law herself, and there's guilt to be found in those kinds of situations. So, you know, whenever you get into that kind of thing, it can be somewhat problematic as to, okay, if we get in the middle of it as a congregation, or I get in the middle of it as a preacher trying to counsel, or the elders have to deal with it in this kind of situation, it can be a can of worms that's opened because there's sin on both sides and such. But ultimately, there is a teaching that is done here that we need to recognize. I didn't realize how long we were taking getting to the point, so we're going to have to actually speak about verses 8 and 9 pretty quickly. So just, if you will, go with it, through it with me in the last 5 minutes we have here. In his explanation, in verse 8, he said, "Moses, because of the hardness of your hearts, permitted you to divorce your wives. From the beginning it was not so." So Moses was not commanding something new. He was regulating the abuses. We've established that. But from the beginning, God's intent from the very beginning, a man shall leave his father and mother, cleave to his wife, the two shall become one flesh. Jesus said, so then, they're no longer two but one. While God is joined together, let not man separate or put asunder. That particular thing is what it's always been in intent. God's law has always been one man, one woman for a lifetime. Now when you get to Christ's authority, but I say to you, he establishes again the law. Remember we said the law was stated in verse 6. While God is joined together, let not man divide. The law is also stated in verse 9, but with the exception offended. So let's read it first in verse 9 without the exception. Just so that we'll know the way the law is put here. I say to you, whoever divorces his wife and marries another commits adultery. And whoever marries her who is divorced commits adultery. That's the law. Because the law is, what God has joined together, man's not to separate. That's the law. And what Dennis indicated in Mark chapter 10, verses 11 and 12, whoever divorces his wife, marries another, commits adultery against her. If a woman divorces her husband, marries another, she commits adultery. That's the law. Romans 7, a woman has a husband, she's bound by law to her husband as long as he lives. That's the law. The law is a simple law. It's really not hard to understand at all. Now, the exception to the law in verse 9, I say to you, whoever divorces his wife except for sexual immorality. That exception changes the clause and marries another commits adultery. So in this particular case, we can say whoever divorces his wife for sexual immorality and marries another does not commit adultery. That's the implication that's found in the exception. Just like a grammatical rule or a spelling rule, I before E, except after C, it sounded as A, as a neighboring way. You know, this is the law, this is the exception to the law. The question that we have to raise is, what is this exception? And the second question, are there any other exceptions? And since we're running out of time, I'll just say the two things. The exception here, sexual immorality, is the Greek word porneia. It has reference to unlawful sexual intercourse. It doesn't have to do with immodesty. It doesn't have to do with the viewing of pornography. It doesn't have to do with certain kinds of lewdness and lasciviousness, although all of those are heinous sins. But it has reference to the sin of sexual intercourse, the unlawful sexual intercourse, which would be inclusive of homosexuality, of premarital sex acts, as well as other kinds of perversions. Those are the things that are under consideration in this particular text. That's what the word porneia indicates. Now, there are some people that have problems with the New King James Version because they didn't use fornication. They use sexual immorality, and that lessens it. No, it doesn't at all. It doesn't at all, because that's what sexual immorality in this context means. That Greek term, you can't change the definition of the term because you use a different phrase. Fornication is kind of an old-fashioned word. And so they use sexual immorality. But it doesn't lessen it or weaken it in any way. It's the same exact thing. Okay, the second question that comes up is, are there any other exceptions to the rule? And that is one man, one woman for a lifetime. And that's where the problem comes in. There are no other exceptions. There is a claim that in 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 15, which we don't have time to discuss, that Paul is making a second exception, but that's not the case.
It took us 6 years to discuss it.
Yeah, well, yeah. Like I said, doing it in one night, I thought I could quickly go over it and get through it without too much trouble, but there's just too much there. So, 1 Corinthians chapter 7, which we have discussed a while back in our Sunday morning class, is not an exception at all. Paul agreed with what Jesus is saying and never gave another exception to it. So, Jesus says, is it lawful? No, it's not. Well, then why did Moses allow this? Because of the hardness of your hearts from the beginning. God never intended it to be this way. And this is what I'm telling you. No. And there's one exception to that no. And that is, you can divorce your spouse because they have been unfaithful to you. Sexual relationship with someone else. And if that's the case, and you put them away for that reason, you have the right to marry without committing adultery. If that's not the reason, you don't have that right. And that's a simple thing. That's a simple law. So, that's what Jesus teaches on it. And the problem is, individuals try.
But I understand what Dad is saying, that if your spouse commits adultery and your spouse repents of it, if you don't take the spouse back, you have a hardness of your heart. Is that what you said?
Not necessarily.
No. It could be the case, and you have to examine your heart. Sure. No, that wasn't his intent. No. Not always.
So, I mean,
what it was saying is that they had hard hearts. If your heart is hard as well, then that's something that's problematic.
Right.
As well.
Because, I mean, you don't need to take your spouse back, but unless you set it up, sometimes it doesn't.
Yeah, we're just out of time. But I appreciate that. Appreciate everyone's kind attention tonight. Thank you.